To these simple practitioners of the open-air life, the settled populations seemed corrupt, crowded, vicious, effeminate, dangerous, and incomprehensible. A detestable human efflorescence upon what would otherwise have been good pasture. They had no use whatever for the towns. The early Franks and the Anglo-Saxon conquerors of South Britain seemed to have had much the same feeling towards townsmen, but it was only under Hulagu in Mesopotamia that these ideas seemed to have been embodied in a deliberate policy. The Mongols here didn't only burn and massacre, they destroyed the irrigation system that had endured for at least 8,000 years, and with that, the mother civilization of all the Western world came to an end. Since the days of the priest kings of Sumeria, there had been a continuous cultivation in these fertile regions, an accumulation of tradition, a great population, a succession of busy cities, Eridu, Nippur, Babylon, Nineveh, Ctesiphon, Baghdad. Now the fertility ceased. Mesopotamia became a land of ruins and desolation, through which great waters ran to waste or overflowed their banks to make malarious swamps. Later on, Mosul and Baghdad revived feebly as second-rate towns. But for the defeat and death of Hulagu's general Kitboga in Palestine in 1260, the same fate might have overtaken Egypt. But Egypt was now a Turkish sultanate. It was dominated by a body of soldiers, the Mamluks, whose ranks, like those of their imitators, the Janissaries of the Ottoman Empire, were recruited and kept vigorous by the purchase and training of boy slaves. A capable sultan, such men would obey. A weak or evil one they would replace. Under this ascendancy, Egypt remained an independent power until 1517, when it fell to the Ottoman Turks. The first destructive vigor of Hulagu's Mongols soon subsided, but in the 15th century, a last tornado of nomadism arose in western Turkestan under the leadership of a certain Timur the Lame, or Timurlane. He was descended in the female line from Genghis Khan. He established himself in Samarkand and spread his authority over Kipchak, Turkestan to South Russia, Siberia, and southward as far as the Indus. He assumed the title of Great Khan in 1369. He was a nomad of the savage school, and he created an empire of desolation from North India to Syria. Pyramids of skulls were his particular architectural fancy. After the storming of Isfahan, he made one of 70,000. His ambition was to restore the empire of Genghis Khan as he conceived it, a project in which he completely failed. He spread destruction far and wide. The Ottoman Turks, it was before the taking of Constantinople and their days of greatness, and Egypt paid him tribute. The Punjab he devastated, and Delhi surrendered to him. After Delhi had surrendered, however, he made a frightful massacre of its inhabitants. At the time of his death in 1405, very little remained to witness to his power but a name of horror, ruins, and desolated countries, and a shrunken and impoverished domain in Persia. The dynasty founded by Timur in Persia was extinguished by another Turkoman horde 50 years later. Fifth E. In 1505, a small Turkoman chieftain, Babea, a descendant of Timur and therefore of Genghis, was forced after some years of warfare and some temporary successes, for a time he held Samarkand, to fly with a few followers over the Hindu Kush to Afghanistan. There his band increased, and he made himself master of Kabul. He assembled an army, accumulated guns, and then laid claim to the Punjab, because Timur had conquered it 107 years before. He pushed his successes beyond the Punjab. India was in a state of division, and quite ready to welcome any capable invader who promised peace and order. After various fluctuations of fortune, Babur met the Sultan of Delhi at Panipat, 1525, 10 miles north of that town, and though he had but 25,000 men, provided, however, with guns against 1,000 elephants and 4 times as many men, the numbers, by the way, are his own estimate, he gained a complete victory. He ceased to call himself King of Kabul and assumed the title of Emperor of Hindustan. This, he wrote, is quite a different world from our countries. It was finer, more fertile, altogether richer. He conquered as far as Bengal, but his untimely death in 1530 checked the tide of Mongol conquest for 250 years, and it was only after the accession of his grandson, Akbar, that it flowed again. Akbar subjugated all India as far as Berar, and his great-grandson, Aurangzeb, 1658-1707, was practically master of the entire peninsula. This great dynasty of Babur, 1526-1530, Humayun, 1530-1556, Akbar, 1556-1605, Jehangir, 1605-1628, Shah Jahan, 1628-1658, and Aurangzeb, 1658-1707, in which son succeeded father for 6 generations. This Mughal, that's to say Mongol, dynasty marks the most splendid age that had hitherto dawned upon India. Akbar, next perhaps to Asoka, was one of the greatest of Indian monarchs, and one of the few royal figures that approach the stature of great men. To Akbar it's necessary to give the same distinctive attention that we have shown to Charlemagne or Constantine the Great. He is one of the hinges of history. Much of his work of consolidation and organization in India survives to this day. It was taken over and continued by the British when they became the successors of the Mughal emperors. The British monarch indeed now uses as his Indian title the title of the Mughal emperors, Kaiser e Hind. All the other great administrations of the descendants of Genghis Khan in Russia, throughout Western and Central Asia, and in China have long since dissolved away and given place to other forms of government. Their governments were indeed little more than taxing governments, a system of revenue collecting to feed the central establishment of the ruler, like the Golden Horde in South Russia, or the imperial city at Karakoram or Pekin. The life and ideas of the people they left alone, careless how they lived, so long as they paid. So it was that after centuries of subjugation, a Christian Moscow and Kiev, a Shiite Persia, and a thoroughly Chinese China rose again from their Mongol submergence. But Akbar made a new India. He gave the princes and ruling classes of India some inklings, at least, of a common interest. If India is now anything more than a sort of rag-bag of incoherent states and races, a prey to every casual raider from the north, it's very largely due to him. His distinctive quality was his openness of mind. He set himself to make every sort of able man in India, whatever his race or religion, available for the public work of Indian life. His instinct was the true statesman's instinct for synthesis. His empire was to be neither a Muslim nor a Mongol one, nor was it to be Rajput or Aryan or Dravidian or Hindu or high or low caste. It was to be Indian.